I want to briefly finish discussing the issue of appliances using the same appliance for dairy and meat. I wanted to quickly wrap that up. We just have to talk about stoves and hot plates, and then we'll spend a little bit of time on Bichl-Occam. So on page 46, source 43. So when it came to ovens, so one of the big concerns about ovens was the issue of Zeya, of the steam. And does the steam from, if you put in dairy and then you put in meat or vice versa, so does the steam, what kind of effect does the steam have? So we discussed a few approaches with that. So a similar issue would be with stovetops, part of the same appliance often, and we use stovetops pretty often, but at the same time, there's a difference because stove, you're cooking on the stove, so it's not enclosed and the food's not, directly on the item. So it's a different, it's a little bit of a different discussion. So can I use the same stovetop for dairy and meat? Of course, another consideration also is that most people don't have multiple stovetops. Even people who have multiple ovens, often it's one on top of the other. It's not so common for people to have multiple stovetops. So what can we do about that? So in source 43, this is a Ramah that a continuation of our Ramah that we saw before in Shulchan Aruch Herodea in Siman Tzadi Beis. And so when it came to having pans, he says to a dairy pan and meat pan, he says, a kol shari midi. If you have, if so, let's say even an oven, if I have, if the dairy thing is covered and the meat is covered, so everything would be allowed. It would be like two pots touching each other. Two pots aren't going to, are just because they touch each other, do not affect the other. So kosher kim b'zeya, when everything's wrapped, so we don't have a problem. So maybe l'chachil one should be careful. So what we see that's relevant when it comes to stovetops is that if I have two pots on the stove, let's say even if they were touching each other, but they were covered, so they would not transfer taste, unless the exception to that being, if this comes up, but the exception to that would be if there was a, if there's liquid involved, let's say, if one pot splashes into another, okay, fine. So you have another issue. Or if the outside of the two pots were both moist, so then maybe we would have an issue. But in theory, two dry pots touching each other would not be a problem. Now, when it comes to the halachas of Pesach, when it comes to stovetops, so he says, Chatzuva tzirich libun. When it comes to a stovetop, so you have to do libun on a stovetop to kashrei, right? You have to, it has to be lit on fire in order to kashrei it.
That's
This
just
is what he says about Pesach. So Mishnah Berurah is going to say that Pesach is different than everything else. First of all, Mishnah Berurah explains what is a chatzuva. If you looked in, if you saw in the translation, source 44, it was not translated directly. It says a chatzuva is a utensil with three legs, and one places a pot or pan on it in the oven on the fire all year round. Sounds like, so again, it's on top of something, but it sounds like it's in the oven. And if one wants to use it for Pesach, so you have to do libun with fire on the on the chatzuva. But he says, "Vezeru rak l'chachil mishum chumra." But the only reason why you have to kasher the chatzuva is because when it comes to chametz, so anything, any chametz whatsoever, doesn't matter how small it is, can make something chafe.
That's like the grate, an oven grate, right?
Oven grates are the what, not the racks, the grates. You're talking about the stovetop rakes.
It says it's a utensil. One places a pot or pan on it in the oven.
Right. So you're saying it's like what?
Oh, it's a grate on a grill, maybe.
But when, but he says when it comes to fine. So with Pesach, we're stricter about this chatzuva. But with that said, year round, when it comes to regular basa b'cholov, so two pots that touch each other aren't going to affect one another. וגם יש לי בו שאף אם נשפח כבר נשרף והלך לו כיוון שבכל שעה היא על האש. So when it comes to, let's say, something on the stove. So let's say, you know, I'm cooking a little soup and it boils over and falls over on the stovetop, it falls on the grates, but it's going to get burned right away if the stove is on. So when it comes to regular basar b'chalav, we don't generally have to worry about the stovetop. Again, the chatzuva seems to be the most comparable thing to a stovetop. But with Pesach, we're a little stricter when it comes to everything else year-round. We don't really seem to have this concern because, again, even if the pots were touching each other, it wouldn't be such a problem. So that's one thing. And, you know, anything that could potentially get on the grates is going to be burned right away. So it's automatically no same time we've come, and it's going to be completely destroyed.
What about if you have you're making chicken soup.
Yeah.
And it's boiling. If it's boiling, you're going to have steam coming out of that pot if the cover is not really tight, which many of them are not. So that steam could get into the next pot.
Well, okay, so we'll clarify in a second about having a dairy meat top on the same time. But let's say just to keep it simple right now. Let's say it's not about having the meat and dairy pot on the stovetop at the same time, but it's just about merely can I use the same stovetop
for
meat and dairy without? No, it's okay. The case that Rama seemed to be bringing up was, you know, when you have them both together. But let's take the easy example for a second that I just wanted to know if I can use the same stovetop, same grates for both dairy and meat. So Zay is obviously not relevant because you know, it's not when it comes to the stovetop. Again, it's not the stovetop is not enclosed. So Mr. Burr seems to be saying that we really don't have an issue around. So Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, it's reported by students in Halichos Shlomo, and again, this comes up, it brings up in the section of Halichos Pesach, but it says year round. And Aginan Levashel Osa Chatzuva Ein Basar V'Ein Chalav. So our custom is to cook both dairy and meat on the same stovetop. And some people might be a little bit stringent about that. However, year round in the home of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, greatest gedolim of the 20th century and Yerushalayim. So in their home, they use the same stovetop for both dairy and meat. So halacha lemaisa, we really don't have a problem using the same stovetop for both dairy and meat. And the note here, it says something about not doing it at the same time. Again, we'll discuss that more in a second. When I looked at the original source, I don't think they actually said that about not, this, but yeah.
Not only the stovetop, they're saying you should designate, you don't have to designate burner one and burner two as always being milachiks.
Correct, exactly.
I saw for the first time in my life by my nephews. How she said, this is a milachik, just put the, if you're cooking milachiks, cook on this particular burner. I know what she's, but that's the first time I ever saw. But
okay, very good. So right, so you know, he says there are some people who are strict, but it's not necessary. So Benjamin Forst, who was the author of the there are two Art Scroll Kasher's books, and he was the author of both of them. So he writes, the stove grates present less of a problem since the flame reaches the grates and presumably burns away any food residue. Therefore, some authorities permit use of the same grates for both meat and dairy. One who notices any meat residue on a grate should remove it before placing on a dairy pot on that grate. He says electric stove ranges the same thing. He says some question this practice advice that one keeps separate grates for each type. So even though we're not saying use a separate stovetop, but maybe having separate grates. So the Sefer Kashrus, page 48, source 48. He says, if I have a stove that's used for both dairy and meat, it should so the problem here we're not concerned about the pots on the stovetop, but when it comes to the actual surface, he says the whole thing should be treated as non-kosher, meaning that you shouldn't put any food directly on the stovetop, and any food that does fall onto it while it's hot should be one should not consume. So in other words, we're saying that I don't really have a concern about the pots themselves. I can put a dairy pot on the same grate as a meat pot in theory. What I do have to be concerned about is, let's say, some chicken soup splatter, some pasta, some pasta that has cheese on it, splatters. So all of that is getting on, all of that's getting on the same stovetop surface. So definitely one should not eat directly from the anything that was on the stovetop. But that doesn't affect the kashrus of the pots. And source 49, Sefer Kasher says, Chov alihimanam b'minasa efshram milavashel amilatagen al-osam kirem al-chay chalav l'machir basar be'es uva'ona achat. He says you should be careful not to cook dairy. You should not be cooking dairy and meat on the same stovetop, but that's only at the same time. Meaning one after another wouldn't be a problem, but not at the same time. When you're cooking or frying, dairy, you should make sure that all the meat utensils are not so close by, especially if you don't need them.
You know what? You know what? The kettle, the glass kettle that you use for whatever, I moved that away so it shouldn't get splattered with some soup or something, making it like flesh. I don't know. You have to wash it.
Last we said year round really doesn't. I guess with hot it's potentially an issue, but
okay.
But now again, it seems like, however, let's say you have a bigger stovetop. So in theory, if the meat and the dairy are on totally different sides, so you really shouldn't have an issue. Definitely don't have to be concerned about the steam getting from one to the other if there's considerable distance, and if they're far enough away that they're not going to splatter on each other. I think it would probably be fine, but again, to whatever extent one can avoid it, there's what to be said for that. When it comes to hot plates, I'm not going to read any of this inside, but hot plates pose an issue that there is food that can splatter on the hot plate, so it's generally discouraged. It's generally discouraged to put both dairy and meat on the same hot plate. Now the Harab Brewer here says that on an occasional basis, it would be acceptable. And the editor has explained here, the reason is that he believes it is permitted to be lenient to allow two pots to touch each other in case of need. Replacing dairy pots or pans on a meat hot plate should be equivalent to two pots touching. So Harab Brewer is not enthusiastic about doing that on a regular basis. But on occasion, it shouldn't be a problem to put schnitzel on a hot plate that is often used for dairy. Of course, you would have to make sure that any residue is cleared off. And when it comes to hot plates, sometimes the residue really is kind of hard to clean off. So in the Tosfot Halacha, it says, case of an electric hot plate where what spills there is not entirely burned, one should not use one hot plate for heating meat dishes and dairy dishes, even consecutively, and even if one is careful to clean the food substance on the hot plate every time. This is because there is still absorption, and if one places a pot whose bottom is wet, will absorb what was absorbed in the hot plate. In the case of great need, one should clean the hot plate from any food substance and watch carefully that the pot with the dairy food is not wet. So the hot plates were a little bit stricter than with the stovetop. Another possibility is also to, if you line the, they don't mention this, but I would think, and I think I've even seen people say this when it comes to Pesach, that if you cover the hot plate with aluminum foil, then you probably have what to rely on there as well. Okay, so that's when it comes, that's using appliances for both meat and dairy. I think for the time being, we are pretty much done talking about Basar B'Challo for the most part. So the next topic that we have here is a concept of Bishul Akum, the concept of a non-Jew cooking for a Jew. So this is the very next section. So I guess it's mine's 61. I don't know when your book diverges.
61.
You have 61. Okay, fine. Bishul Akum. We'll discuss very shortly what the reason for the potential prohibition for a non-Jew to cook for a Jew. There are some nuances to this discussion based on the type of food and also the manner that it's done. So as a word of introduction, you should just note that there is a little bit of a, I won't say an evolution, but there are multiple steps for understanding what is actually prohibited under the law of Bishul Akum. The concept of Bishul Akum appears in the Mishnah. The Gemara will suggest that perhaps there's a Torah source for it, but the most direct instruction about this is in the Mishnah in Avodah Zarah, in source one. Ve'elu dvarim shel goyim asurim. These are the things that that a Gentile makes that is prohibited. Ve'ein isur and isur hana. However, it's not forbidden to benefit from it. Meaning to say that when it comes to a mixture of dairy and meat, not a lot of benefit from it at all. But when it comes to the following things, I don't have to worry, but I'm not allowed to eat it, but benefiting is not an issue. So one example, chalav shechalavo goy, milk that was milked by a Gentile, ve'ein isur ro'ehu, and a Jew is not watching. So I don't assume it's talk about all of Israel, but I'll just say, yeah, we're going to talk about that's the next year. So we'll talk about the work, the 20th and 21st century workaround with Chalav Yisrael. But so milk is potentially an issue.
Milk is cow's milk. We don't know it's cow's milk, right?
What?
When the Mishnah says chalav, it doesn't necessarily mean chalav is from a cow.
Correct.
Right. So that was the issue.
I mean,
now it's not an issue.
we'll talk about milk.
Okay.
Pots, bread was also something that, in theory, one should not eat from non-Jew. Shem and shelahem, oil as well. Shlakos. Shlakos refers to cooked food. Right now, we're going to focus more on the shlakos when it comes to bread and to milk, and cheese for that matter. So again, that's going to be the next section whenever we get to that. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah asked a question. So we said that not allowed to eat cooked foods by non-Jew. So Gemara wants to know, where did they get this from? So Rechia Bar Abba says the name of Rabbi Yochanan, Amar Kra, Ochel Bakesev Tashbi Reini, V'achalti Umayim Bakesev Titem Li V'shatiti. So when Bnei Yisrael were passing through the land of Sichon, the land of the Amorites, so Moshe requested that they be given the opportunity not to take food, but to be able to buy food, and that they should be able to have water. So the Gemara says, "Kamayim." We're going to make a comparison between food and water. Ma'amayim shelo nishtanu, just like water, it doesn't change. At any point, however the non-Jew gets the water out of the well or out of the river, is the exact same as the way it's consumed. Of ochal shelo nishtana, it's only permitted. It would only have been permitted. The only kind of food that would be permitted for Bnei Yisrael to have is food that didn't change its form. In other words, that wasn't cooked. It sounds like from this that if I have wheat and I make it into roasted grains, make it into bread, so wheat should also be prohibited. But that doesn't make sense because there's a baraita that says that if I have wheat and it's turned into roasted grain, so it's permitted. No, this is the prohibition of eating cooked food from a non-Jew is a rabbinic prohibition. Ukra asmachta ba'alma. So there's a hint at this in the Torah, but the prohibition of Bishul Akum, the prohibition of eating food cooked by non-Jew, is fundamentally a rabbinic prohibition. So that seems to be the Gemara's conclusion. Now, we're going to discuss next is the purpose of Bishul Akum. And that's important to discuss because there are a lot of implications to this, especially because it's Gzeira Derabanan, so seemingly. So when does it apply? When it doesn't apply? What are the nuances of these cases? So Tosfos say, in the name of Rabbeinu Tam, so the whole discussion about whether cooked food is prohibited from the Torah or from the rabbis. So from the fact that the Torah has to even ask if it's deraisa, So it must mean that it was one of the earlier decrees. Even if it's not a prohibition from the Torah directly to eat food that was cooked by a non-Jew, it was certainly a very early decree. Earlier than, for example, the decree not to have bread from a non-Jew.
What is this term, shlako? And it's not used anywhere. Why are we
shlako
using
is it? Cooked food.
It's a general, what is it, Aramaic?
Any food that's cooked. You take food that's raw, that can't be eaten, not cooked, and you cook it, it becomes edible. So that's what we're referring to when it comes to shlako.
Is that Aramaic or Hebrew?
I think it's Hebrew because it's in the Mishnah. We don't use that term a lot. It comes up in the earlier version of Manishtana that's in the Mishnah, I believe. It's not a word that's used in modern Hebrew, but and I think in the Gemara Brachos in some cases it's used to refer to vegetables, but here it's being used to refer to any cooked food. So Rabbeinu Tam implies or says that maybe this is not exactly biblical in origin, but it is a relatively early decree to not eat food cooked by a non-Jew. So then in the bold, Rabbeinu Tam says, Mitchila gazro leha mitam pasnas. The reason why they prohibited a Jew to eat food cooked by a non-Jew was to prevent intermarriage. It says, well, Apostle Gazru, originally bread was not prohibited because eating bread is, you know, bread is bread, and you know, eating bread cooked by a non-Jew would not necessarily lead to intermarriage. That was originally the original thought. So bread, actually, for what it's worth, does get brought under this umbrella of forbidden items to eat because of concern of intermarriage. But when it comes to shlakos, when it comes to cooked food, so Rabbeinu Tam says that the reason for this is having to do with intermarriage. Now, with that said, there's a little bit of a disagreement among the Rishonim about this. So Yagos Hagaos Ashiri, I'm commenting on the Rush, this is source 4 on page 63, says, "Debishul goyim nasar mishum gzera shema yachilan goy davar tamei." What's the reason that a Jew shouldn't eat something cooked by a non-Jew? It's because there was a concern that the non-Jew might give something not kosher to the Jew. So that's what the Agos Ashiri says. And Rashi says, Rashi gives both reasons, but in two different places. So on the Mishnah we mentioned before, he says the reason why you can't eat something cooked by a non-Jew is mishum chatnas, because of the concern of intermarriage. However, later on the Gemara, so when the Gemara says that this is prohibited from the rabbis, Rashi says, "Shelo yehi Yisrael ragil etzel b'machal amishta ve'achilon davar tamen." So maybe a Jew will, if they're associating too much with a non-Jew, so the non-Jew might feed somebody a non-kosher item. Whether that is intentional, whether it's accidental, I don't know if we know. The concern is that it's malicious per se, but it could very well be accidental. So Rashi presents both reasons, that there was a concern that the eating food cooked by a non-Jew could have implications for the issue of intermarriage, and there was a actual kashrus concern of accidentally eating something not kosher. One thing leads to another. So what do you mean by that?
In other words, you sort out by, you know, here, have this, and it's not kosher, then why not start dating? Why not start?
Okay, right. So there's that familiarity. So Joseph was saying that, first it's you give, the non-Jew gives you something small to eat, and then there's that familiarity that breeds, and you eat together more, and there's more familiarity. So that's certainly something that that Chazal had in mind. So nowadays you could say that associating at a restaurant, if you're going out to eat together, so that also adds a little bit of familiarity.
But the cook in the kitchen of a restaurant, you don't see this guy.
Okay, so right, so I think from the perspective of Chazal, what we have to be talking about here is like restaurants were probably, there were inns that, you know, if you're traveling, so you'd stop somewhere and somebody would cook something. But even then, you probably actually weren't. You were either interacting with the cook because they were your host, or because like they were the innkeeper who might have been cooking for you. Concept of a so now when you have somebody, you know, the guy behind the pizza counter, so correct. You're not really interacting. You're not really interacting with those guys. So that is like an interesting calculus. I think one thing I would say on top of that is that even if, so one thing could be that is about the food itself and who cooked the food. And yeah, maybe nowadays, the non-Jew isn't really interacting. The non-Jewish cook is not interacting with the Jew. But let's say you go to a restaurant that's, let's say it's all really kosher, but there's bishul akum. So, but it's not technically a kosher restaurant. So then, in that case, it could be still a place where non-Jews and Jews are likely to be able to meet. So maybe it's not just about the cooking, but it's about like the, the getting together with the food that was cooked by a non-Jew means that, that there's more likely that there's non-Jews present. But anyway, the Aruch HaShulchan says that Rov Poskim say, most of the Poskim say that the real reason why you can't have cooked food is because there was a concern of intermarriage. Some who say that the reason is because non-kosher. That's why so he's quoting Rashi there. And he says, "After Shetamo hu lama hikilu bepasvelo b'shlakos." So it's perhaps the reason that Rashi mentions both reasons is related to why they were lenient concerning bread originally, not for cooked foods. Or actually, there are also leniencies with bread that exists that don't exist with other cooked foods, even nowadays. Since there are two reasons for cooked foods as to why they're forbidden. And concerning bread, the second concern related to eating a forbidden item is not relevant, as regarding bread, what is inside is clearly visible in contrast to cooked foods. Therefore, they were stringent for cooked foods and not for bread. In other words, the reason why Rashi mentions both reasons is because, let's say you want to say, well, Bishul Akum is not really relevant anymore, and maybe it's not prohibited anymore. So that was easier to do with bread, because the only reason why the prohibition of bread could possibly be forbidden is related to intermarriage. But bread is not going to be treif, right? We don't have to be concerned for the most part that someone's going to feed treif bread. But that said, there is non-kosher bread that's made.
Lard
and stuff. But I think back then, it's like, you saw the person putting the wheat and the water together and it's bread, and it's like, what else could possibly be in there? But when it comes to other cooked food, So milk we're also going to milk we'll discuss at a later point. But when it comes to other cooked food, so you have two reasons. So that makes it easier to do away with the prohibition. So in light of the Aruch HaShulchan, which tells us that there are two reasons for the prohibition of Bishul Akum, both of them are necessary. So there's an interesting discussion about the non-observant Jew and possibly on the apostate, somebody who converts out of Judaism. And this is brought in the Pitchei Tshuva. Pitchei Tshuva appears on the page of Shulchan Aruch in the Yordaya section. It's an 18th century compilation of various tshuvos that are related to the topics being discussed on the page of the Shulchan Aruch. Tshuvos that were obviously relevant to that point in different Piskei Halacha. So whether Bishul Akum was prohibited because of the concern of intermarriage or because of the concern that they will make something treif, so that's practical ramifications for this discussion. So Tiferes Lamosha is quoted in the Piskei Tshuva saying, "The feet tam zeshar bishul shel mumar." You're allowed to, according to the intermarriage concern, you would be allowed to have the food cooked by a mumar. Mumar can really mean a couple of different things. I think in some cases it means an apostate, but it can also mean somebody who is non-observant. I'm actually not entirely clear what's being brought down here, and I can understand it both ways. But when it comes to a mumar, So the concern of intermarriage doesn't matter. Right? When it comes to a non-observant Jew, so obviously a Jew is allowed to marry a non-observant Jew or the child of a non-observant Jew, so that's definitely not an issue. Could be even with an apostate. If we say, Afal pi shechata Yisrael hu, so So maybe the children are Jewish, or if it's the man, then you know, the children are still Jewish. So so I could see that going both ways. But either way, a concern of intermarriage doesn't exist when it comes to the Mumar. We have concern that a mumar, even if we're not concerned about eating together leading to intermarriage, we are concerned that the non-Jew who's cooking for the Jew, sorry, not the non-Jew, that the mumar who is cooking for the Jew, so they could still either intentionally or unintentionally make something treif. If you have a Jew who is desecrating Shabbos in public, or cholatar kula, or they're desecrating the entire Torah, so dino kagoy. So as far as this is concerned, he has the status of non-Jew, and he's not allowed to cook things. So again, so these two reasons brought by the Aruch HaShulchan, in particular, the concern about cooking something treif does have practical ramifications. So there are some leniencies potentially for a non-observant Jew to cook for a Jew, to be involved in the food production process. So Tzitz Eliezer says that we don't have to worry about Bishuli Akum when it comes to non-observant Jews for canned goods and things that are cooked in factories. Even if the owners are porke ol mechale Shabbos Kodesh befarhesi rachman alatzan, so even if the owner is not observant and is a public desecrator of Shabbos, so kshiyesh b'muna aleihem ben tor v'yerushalayim hamed al gabav fakeach mashgiach v'ayin pekucha akol naaseh sham. So if you have a mashgiach there who's observing what's going on, so we don't have to worry. We don't really have anything to worry about. That's it's Eliezer's leniency, especially in the context of somebody who's involved in mass food production. That said, Rav Avad Yosef is a little bit stricter when it's possible. He recommends being stricter, especially if the food's been cooked at home. So he says, Harachti b'siyata d'shmar b'din b'shul mumar l'chal shabbat b'parhesed im yesh bo din b'shul goyim v'leiti b'kocha d'etera. I think it's technically permitted for somebody who is not observant to cook for an observant Jew. And that's with regard to canned foods made in non-religious kibbutzim. So he says, sorry, that only because we want to try to do things the best way possible. So when food is being produced, let's say in a kibbutz where people are not observant, so just to be safe, so the mashkiach should turn on the buttons that begin the machines for the factory. That's only just to try to do the best. So he says that technically there's permission to for non-observant Jews to be involved in the production process, but if it's possible to have a mashkiach involved in fulfilling the technical aspects of Bishul Akum, we'll talk about the notion of how we get around some of the issues of Bishul Akum. So, but with that said, he says that if a mashkiach can just fulfill the technical requirement to turn on the machine, so that's good. And then the Sefer Kashrus comes along and says, so for nowadays, somebody who's Mechal Shabbos, Sefer Kashrus says in source 11, somebody who's not observant, so are they considered to be a non-Jew? And some say that there are those who could be lenient. So if you look at the footnotes on the bottom of page 66, so Sefer Kashrus talks about that you don't, it's one thing for the cook to be secular, but if they reform, it's more problematic. So here they go at length to explain that perhaps there's a concern that people who are, anti-religion So there you have, so maybe there you have real issues. But the argument that might be made, you can make this argument both in Israel, but especially in the United States, is that at this point, people who are not observant are not doing so for rebellious reasons, which is what the implication of the word mumar. Where mumar is somebody who is being rebellious. So we're generally not so concerned nowadays that non-observant Jews are being rebellious. But that's the way they grew up. Some people call that tinok shenishba. You know, it's a concept in the Rambam that a child who is in captivity and doesn't know the religion, so you know, they're exempt in certain ways. We look at them differently. So there are reasons maybe not to use the term tinok shenishba, brought by both Rabbi Lichtenstein and Rabbi Nachum Rabinovich, whose yahrzeit is tomorrow. But so the whole sugya of how we look at non-observant Jews is just very different today because in most cases it's just how they grew up and they're not being rebellious. There was a conservative rabbi who wrote a tshuva specifically with wine, but this gets extrapolated, who said that that the concerns of Jews, of non-Jews, cooking food, serving wine, etc., is not relevant nowadays because it's not really going to do anything to prevent intermarriage. He says if it were to do anything to prevent intermarriage, maybe I'd say otherwise, but he doesn't think it would do anything. Mm-hmm. I think that the non-Orthodox who've dismissed Bishul Akum and things related to wine, they've made a very grave mistake, because at the end of the day, when you think about it, where is this, where are people meeting? They're meeting at restaurants, at bars. So I think it's a big mistake to dismiss, to dismiss lightly that, if we told people that, you're not allowed to have the food or the wine of a non-Jew, that it's not a problem. It's still entirely relevant issue that we still deal with nowadays. And, I think that, an important step in talking about intermarriage is that, you're not even supposed to be, even be eating the food that was cooked exclusively by a non-Jew. So there's a lot to say about that, but these halachos, I think, in that sense, are still very relevant. Okay.